Welcome to the Analytics Dynasty Daily Podcast. I'm your host, Jordan McNamara. Special Sunday strategy session, a Sigmund strategy session. My guest, Sigmund Bloom. Sig, thanks for joining us. I wanted to talk to you in particular because I have some Syracuse basketball questions that we'll get to. But
yes,
I wanted to talk to you because your story fascinates me from Syracuse Law School, or excuse me, from Syracuse, then to law school, and then ultimately to Football Guys. Can you sort of talk about how that happened and how you sort of found yourself, how that career arc happened?
Yeah.
Because it's something I'm living through.
This is going to take up the whole hour, right? You got to watch out. Because when I tell a story, I have to tell other stories to explain things in the story. And the next thing you know, we're all the way back to like the earth cooled and dinosaurs ruled the earth. I was a sports fanatic as a kid. I could not get enough sports. My first true love was probably March Madness, staying up late to watch the tape delay games at 7 years old. All my teachers in elementary school on knew that the first 2 days of the tournament, I just wasn't going to be at school. I would do all my assignments like Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. I love the Pirates. I would listen to radio broadcasts of the Pirates. I would keep score in my own little notebook at home. I wanted to be the Pittsburgh Pirates play-by-play announcer. Of course, there was the Steelers, Pitt basketball. I was a Pittsburgh kid, Pitt football. And I couldn't get enough. And then when they tell you when you're in high school, you can do whatever you want. You can be whatever you want. Like, yeah, I want to be a sportscaster. I ended up at Syracuse Newhouse School. Folks that know. I lasted a year and a half. Broadcast journalism. It just wasn't me. It reminds me of when I got to law school, where you look around the room and you think, I must have showed up at the wrong room because this isn't where I belong. And also at the time, broadcast journalism was a terrible profession. The prospects were get placed somewhere like, and I'm sorry to these places, I'm not trying to put them down. If you love Fargo, North Dakota, or Jackson, Mississippi, you know, or St. George, Utah, or something like that. I mean, you would start somewhere wherever they could get a job at like $19,000 a year. In the 90s, still, that wasn't very much. And also, it wasn't just journalism. You had, in hindsight, they gave you some really good skills. Like you had to set up the camera and frame your shot. You had to do your sound. You had to edit it. You know, you had to do everything. You had to do your whole segment from end to end, which that was, I wanted to just watch sports and talk about it, you know? So I didn't last very long. I went to law school, well, because I didn't know what to do. I didn't want to be a philosophy professor. I ended up in philosophy and policy studies. Didn't want to be a philosophy professor. Didn't want to work. People that had four-year degrees at that time, you were going to work for like Arthur Anderson and stuff like that. Come on, no. I didn't want to do that. Law school sounded okay, but I picked a law school based on where I wanted to live, not the law school itself, although UT Law School in Texas is pretty good. I knew on the first day of law school I didn't belong there. Mm-hmm. This is one of those things, I have to say it just for the completeness of the story. It's not a humble brag, but I guess by saying that, it makes it a humble brag. When I say I was lucky enough to have a full scholarship to UT Law, so I could be a professional student for 3 years and try to figure out what I was going to do, because I knew I wasn't going to be an attorney. Actually, I'm telling a more full version of the story, because I know we're going to have an hour and we can do big picture stuff. So actually, I toyed with being a professional astrologer. I read up on that. I have fortune tellers in my family. In some ways, we are astrologers, right, Jordan?
Yeah.
In some ways, we do pretend that we can tell the future. So I'm not too far off from that. Have we done any analytics on horoscopes of players? You know, like which sun sign wide receivers do the best whenever the moon is in Capricorn and things like that. Anyway, I toyed with a bunch of different things. I actually tried to be a defense attorney for a few months. And one problem was I believed everything my clients told me and I couldn't negotiate, which I've gotten a little better at since I started playing more fantasy football. And then there's another side story to this that I actually didn't get my driver's license until I was 24. Another story. And I borrowed some money from my grandfather and I got my license and I got a car so I could be a defense attorney. And within about 2 months of that, I totaled the car, which told me like, you should have never gotten a driver's license. You should have never, I think for me, it was actually a metaphor for being afraid of life. Of being afraid of like getting out there, because you could hurt yourself, you could hurt others, but you can also go places. I was like, I just want to stay at home. I'm a house cat. So that also put the kibosh on the momentum of that. I actually got a job at UT. They had a really great thing going at the time where they would train you to be a systems analyst. If you aced an aptitude test to show that you had aptitude to learn coding, they figured it was easier to take somebody who could communicate verbally well, who had a personality, and teach them to code than to take somebody who say had a computer science degree, but couldn't work with clients. you know. Plus, it's UT. They have their own coding language. They do things their own way because it's Texas, man. So they like to train their own homegrown systems analysts. They weren't just getting software systems out of the box and getting people that were conversant in those systems. They were actually building the system and having the people that they were training build new parts of the system. That wasn't really for me. I'm not super detailed oriented. However, I did like being at a computer all day because I could manage all my fantasy teams. And then at a certain point, I said, well, why shouldn't I try to make this my job? Because it's something I like doing more than my job. Sorry, UT, it's something I was doing while I was at my job. And then the last thing we just talked about before we went on the air was my dear friend, Jeff Wilson, and I, and a few other people were hit by a car after a Black Crowes concert waiting to cross the street. And he didn't survive. I woke up in the hospital. I still don't remember it to this day. He didn't survive. And that really drove home that you have to try to make the life you want now. You can't wait for it to be easy. You can't wait for everything to line up. And I think for everybody out there, if you put something out into the universe, a wish out into the universe, something will come back. Maybe not what you're wishing for. Maybe not exactly what you envisioned, but something will come back. And us having this conversation right now, Jordan, is one of those waves coming back to the shore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you then, how do you take a stop before, you were working on your own before you came to Football Guys, right?
Kind of. So I started out at Football Guys on the Newswire. They used to have something way, way back in the day where you just had an RSS feed of sites that had news and you combed all the stories for news and you hand entered the Newswire. Now it's obviously a lot more automated. I think it was like $5 an hour, which was great. Yeah. $5 an hour to read football stories.
Right.
Yes. I was doing that on the weekends. Common story in our industry, right? Doing it on the weekends, doing it when I had time. But I was also writing articles at the Shark Pool. I was posting them at the Shark Pool, the Football Guys message board, where you just hoped somebody like Bob Henry or Jason Wood or Morrill Tremblay or John Norton would actually just comment on your article and acknowledge your existence. That was a big deal. That was a really big deal. And maybe Joe Bryan or David Dodds, but come on, let's not get carried away here.
Right.
But that was the proving ground. And let me tell you, Jordan, I walked to work at UT every day, 15 minutes each way. And I would often visualize things. I would daydream, you know. And I would visualize getting the message from Joe Bryant in my DMs in the message board saying like, hey, buddy, we've been watching your work. We're really impressed with what you're doing. We'd like for you to come on and write for us. I would visualize that. And one day it happened.
Mm-hmm.
And then because Cecil and I were so geeked out on the NFL draft and there wasn't really a lot of NFL draft coverage out there. And back then, if you went to the Senior Bowl, if you went to the Shrine Game, there was very few people covering it. You were one of the only people giving firsthand reports of what was happening in these practices with these prospects that are about to enter the NFL. We said, let's go for this. Let's try to create. We started Draft Guys. We started a short form video series, Draft Guys TV. We did the 5-minute drill, which was hard hitting.
So amazing.
Yeah, it was fun. We were just Jordan, have they figured out how to monetize video yet? I still feel like they haven't. So we were just way ahead of, it was the internet gold rush of 2007, whenever they thought, video, that's where all the money's going to be.
Yeah.
And yeah, it petered out. The financial crash happened. But then intervening events led up to the possibility of having the opportunity to work at Football Guys full time. But absolutely, you have to rub two sticks together. Absolutely, you have to choose work. And I don't want to tell people work for free, but I will say do work that you like doing, because then the work is its own reward and you're not focused on where you're headed, because that is the kind of thing that can actually emotionally, psychologically, spiritually get you kind of jammed up. Because man, you see people out there getting ahead, not doing things the right way, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And when you want that goal, it challenges your values. And I think that our values still in the end guide us to where we end up. So I was lucky that it was a time. I just feel lucky that I had, if there's one moral of the story, Jordan, it is take a risk before it's clear that it's a good risk to take.
That's great. That's really good. It's funny because someone had posted recently on Twitter something about, you know, would you rather basically kind of have do your work through your content, like have people find you that way, or do it through networking? And I was kind of like, well, it's really the goal that you want, right? Do you want the celebrity status, or do you want the actual substance to be the substance mm-hmm. person? And I think that that's a you know, it's interesting that I think you've become very much a celebrity, but you came from it from a very, substance base, you know, from the beginning.
I'm doing the work that I want to do. And the thing is, mm-hmm. it's just like dating, right? Like if you pretend to be somebody when you're dating someone and it works, well, now what are you going to do? You have to pretend to be that.
Right.
You have to pretend to be that person for the rest of your life now. Right. So if you do the work that naturally flows from you that you like doing, instead of calculating and doing things to say, well, how can I get attention? How can I skip steps? How can I cut corners? Then you have to keep doing that. It's kind of like the Mark Twain quote about, you know, I tell the truth, so I don't have to remember what I said, you know? And I think that the beautiful thing is there's room at the table for everybody at this point, you know? Yeah. It's not a zero-sum game. It isn't. I think that that's something that happened in the fantasy football industry when DFS came along, and all of a sudden there was money. And now with the sports betting, there's going to be even more money. It's all merging. So, you know, do what you like, have a good time. And look, as a tip, right, work that has enthusiasm, passion, positivity behind it is more attractive work. Those qualities attract people to you. So if you're coming from that place, you're more likely to be successful, even if you shouldn't do it as a strategy. You should just do it because it feels good.
Yeah, it's funny. When I was in, I was in law school and, it was actually college, I think. I had come home for the summer. So this would have been like late, like maybe 08, 09, somewhere in that range. And it was back before iPhones and smartphones were really a thing. And I had an MP3 player and I'd work for my dad, doing work around the house and, or he had like a rental property. So I'd go paint it or whatever, you know, I'd spend a couple weeks doing that in the summer. And it would be this time of year. And it would be, I would download all of the Football Guys podcasts at that point, you know, and they were MP3s really at that point. And it was, you know, I would just listen to you and Cecil every day, like the entire, I would download them all and have them on my MP3 player. And it's just so funny how from that, I mean, now this is 13, 14 years later. And it's, you know, just how different the world changed, but it's funny that we're sort of, you know, where we find ourselves. Cause that's where I came from being a Football Guys fan and not to being here. It's interesting. Can you talk a little bit about your ranking process? So rankings fascinate me, and I've done Dynasty rankings for 1 year and I said, I can't ever do them again because it's the most, nerve-wracking thing in terms of what I'm actually aiming for. And it's fascinating. You watch them, you look at them. Are you aiming for, are you trying to predict the upside? Are you trying to predict like a median, mm-hmm. Protect against the downside, like protect against catastrophe? Sort of how do you value that in your rankings?
There's no easy answer. And one of the dirty secrets of rankings, I think anybody that's being honest is, if I sit down right now and do a set of rankings and then at 2 o'clock this afternoon, I do them again, they're going to be different. Mm-hmm. And I do them again at 6 o'clock tonight, they're going to be different. Even if nothing changed, you know,
mm-hmm.
because it's not defined. It's not mathematical. It's presented in a mathematical fashion, but it's not mathematical. And depending on who knows, you see different players in different lights. So what am I doing when I'm doing rankings? Well, first of all, and I know this might sound elementary, Jordan, but I've realized that you can't just assume that something is elementary to you or that just feels elementary. It's like we always say, know your scoring system and lineups.
Mm-hmm.
And that just sounds so elementary. But folks, that's the biggest edge that you can have in fantasy football, is really knowing every iota of your scoring system and lineups and how it affects player values and how it affects your choices when you're setting your lineup and making trades and waiver wire decisions and things like that. So my basic test is, and again, this sounds so obvious, when I have a player ranked above another player, would I actually take that player over that player? Or in dynasty rankings, would I trade that player for that other player? Now, it's still not one size fits all, because depending on what else is on your roster, and also we're publishing rankings, you know, we can break them out by scoring system, but even when we break them out by scoring system, it may change the answer of who you would take in a draft or who you would trade for who, depending on who else is on your roster, where your team's situated and things like that. So that's what I start with. And I think what informs that question, would I actually take this player over that player? Would I actually trade this player for that player? Is can this player change the destiny of my team? Can I think of a story where this player ends up being an important player on my team? And I think that's where projections versus rankings can steer us astray, because you can project a player with some high degree of confidence that they will be, say, in the 30th to 35th ranked running back at the end of the year when we use cumulative stats, and yet it will be a player who will not change the destiny of your team at all. Whereas a 60th ranked running back that I can only project for, say, 30 carries, I can envision scenarios where they become a really important player in fantasy football. So I'm going to move that player up.
Yeah,
I'm going to move that 60th ranked guy up, even if there's only a 5% chance that he's going to move the needle, when a player that I know is going to touch the ball 120 times, but never more than 6 or 7 times in a game, is not going to move the needle, even though projections tell us that player is more valuable. So I think you're definitely looking at ceiling, and you're definitely looking at narrative to say, how is there, another term I like to use in my brain, in my head, as I think this stuff out toward, is a path to value. Is there a path to value for this player? If this happens, how would it change their value? If this happens, how would it change their value? You know, we could look at the Tennessee Titans, for instance, right? If Derrick Henry goes down, as some predict, because of his heavy workload, I don't buy it. Are we going to want to have Darrington Evans or Brian Hill?
Yeah, the numbers would say to me it's Darrington Evans, but that doesn't seem to make sense.
Right?
You know what I mean? Like every analytical side of me was like, you take the third round draft pick over the guy that has bounced around in the league and not really done much. But at the same time, you're like, are they really going to do that? Like, is that what's going to happen?
And the point is not what's the right answer, because who knows what the right answer is. It's that nobody would say Brian Hill. But yet when you stop to think about it, if we're actually put on the spot during the season, and we're assuming Brian Hill makes the team, by the way, which isn't obvious. But if it's week 7 and Derrick Henry goes down and we're talking about waiver wire, all of a sudden, even if you hadn't even considered Brian Hill until that moment, you ask yourself, well, are they going to go to Evans or are they going to go to Hill? Because Hill's actually the downhill runner. Hill's the guy that you don't really have to change anything for. And Evans is the guy that changes the complexion. So the point is, these are the kinds of things you're asking yourself whenever you're putting rankings together. And I think that upside, can this player move the needle to help my fantasy team, is the question you should be asking yourself in fantasy football always. Look, we get to color in lines and make 55-45 calls like in our life. Like, do that with your retirement stock portfolio. You know, not with your fantasy team. Have some fun with your fantasy team.
Yeah. Do you find that values a little bit different up at the top of the board versus down further? So that up at the top of the board, you know, the profiles might be a little bit closer. You might lean one way or another. Like, it might be pretty close in terms of upside versus safety and those sorts of things. Whereas you go further down the board, you'll be, you know, let's just take upside shots down further down the board.
Yes, absolutely. Look, there's a point in your draft. Redraft, let's say 6th, 7th, 8th round, then you should be only looking at upside. Don't draft for depth. Don't draft for depth. And now, if you're doing a best ball league, that's a little different. But if you're talking about a classic lineup setting redraft league, do not draft for depth, because depth is the residue of good roster management. If you're making good waiver wire pickups, if you make good late round pickups, you're going to have depth. Depth is going to be created just as a byproduct of good roster management. You're always thinking about upside. Now, you're right. When you're talking about 1st, 2nd, 3rd round picks, now we're splitting more hairs. Now, the upside of Joe Mixon still might not be as attractive as that warm, fuzzy shelter of Nick Chubb, right? I mean, Kareem Hunt could get hurt, but Nick Chubb's probably capped at like 18 or 20 touches a game. Nick Chubb's not going to catch more than, 30 balls, right? But Nick Chubb's probably going to score a touchdown a game. And Nick Chubb is probably going to be in, even in the worst, there may be, if you even look at last year, there was one week, that first week against Baltimore, I think that they just got housed in that game. But otherwise, Nick Chubb was extremely steady for you and did occasionally contribute a ceiling game. Maybe not a ceiling game to the tune of what guys like Mixon, you know, Akers was going in that same range. Antonio Gibson may get up to that range now. Austin Eckler's in that mix. A lot of see Eckler going ahead of Barkley. Maybe Barkley is more like the guy that you're weighing there. So you're right to say it's always upside, 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 upside. Whenever you're looking at players in the early rounds, you might prefer that safety to the upside, and it's rational. So it is more nitpicking and splitting hairs, but that's what we do. That's what we put ourselves out there to do. So we got to do it.
Yeah. Who's the furthest down running back you could see? Like, who's your darkest horse candidate to finish as running back one?
Running back one. Wow. I mean, look, if we're saying no injuries, we assume everyone plays 17 games. That list is really short.
Right.
If everyone plays 17 games, that list ends at like Mixon probably. Mm-hmm. Mixon is probably the lowest guy. I think Najee Harris could still be very good for his investment, but the offensive line will keep him from being the RB1. Aaron Jones, every time I look at the Green Bay backfield, I wonder, is AJ Dillon going to do more than we expect?
I hope so.
Well, because there's a factor here, Jordan. Again, this is where narrative belongs in fantasy football. This is mm-hmm. where it's not just purely analytical. Will Matt LaFleur and Brian Gutekunst, especially if Aaron Rodgers doesn't show up, force AJ Dillon onto the field more to show just how brilliant their plan was, just how smart they were to take those players, even though Aaron Rodgers was upset about it? It's not purely based on rational coaching. I think that if we're saying every running back plays 17 games, I think it's a short list. It's basically McCaffrey, Henry, Kamara, Cook, Zeke, because of the touchdown upside, mm-hmm. and Mixon, and that's probably it. You know, if McCaffrey plays 17 games, he's probably it anyway. Mm-hmm. Now, if we open it up and we say anything can happen because of injuries, you know, then you start looking at some players that might be not as highly regarded, like Chris Carson, I think, is a guy that is being overlooked. We have to at least open up the possibility even for players like Javonte Williams. I mean, how high does Javonte Williams go, Jordan, if Melvin Gordon gets traded to the Rams, for instance?
Yeah.
Now you have people pretty taking him in the late second round, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm certainly open to that, but I think we're cheating if we say based on injury. So I think it's actually a very short list, and there's Joe Mixon again on that list.
Yeah. Interesting. Eckler is it was the guy that you mentioned that brought up that question, because mm-hmm. like if the there's going to be injuries, so it's tough to, you know, if there isn't, if you play this out chalk, like it's going to be like there, I think you're right, there's a limited number of guys, but if we get a chaos year like last year, like if Eckler can survive
season,
like it could be 1800 yards, and you know, yes. He just needs his touchdowns. Like the touchdowns need to come for him, and they just haven't yet.
And usage could change without Anthony mm-hmm. Lynn there. And we don't know what Eckler will look like. And if Joe Lombardi does it, that's a name we got to remember here. If this is an efficient offense, we don't know what Eckler can look like in an offense with a good offensive line. For the first time ever, Jordan, we can say the Chargers have a good offensive line. Yeah, right. And if Justin Herbert takes another step forward, we don't know what Eckler can do in a offense that's clicking, an offense that's hitting on all cylinders. So Eckler's an exciting player. When I saw Eckler go ahead of Barkley in the Pros versus Joe draft I just did, I said, I like that. I actually think that's probably a good choice.
Yeah, it's interesting. So you talked about the narrative. How do you sort of, you might be the biggest news consumer that I know. Mm-hmm. How do you sort of sort that process between just straight up drinking from a fire hose and drowning versus sort of processing all of that information?
I think some of it is just living and having experience in life and understanding how every story unfolds on its own logic and path. There is nothing that's random in the universe, right? Right, Jordan? Would you agree with that?
Yeah, largely.
Nothing is random. Nothing is truly random.
Except when touchdown rate.
I love it. That's perfect. That's really perfect. That's a perfect answer to take a philosophical, large-reaching question back down to fantasy football. But that's one of the things we love about it, is it implicates all of these things as we think about it. Nothing is truly random. It seems random to us because we don't have access to all the information that would have made that just seem as logical as anything, that that's what would happen next, right? Black swans and things like that, right? So I think that you get used to understanding that even so-called outliers, there are indicators, right? There are markers that we can go back and say, you know, this is going to eventually lead to Kyle Pitts, right? But mm-hmm. there are indicators that say that. So this is where I think analytics. So let me take a step back and say everything that everybody that's doing algorithms, analytics, data models, data visualization, all these different things, they have done an immense service, not just for fantasy football, but I think for football. I think that fantasy football in the community has helped move the ball down the field in football analysis for the NFL and how football is covered and how it is presented and how fans can engage with it. So when I say this about analytics, it is not to downplay or belittle analytics and their usefulness, but I have always seen analytics as useful for finding questions to ask, but not to answer the questions. Because where I think analytics fail us is you're throwing a bunch of disparate cases into one bucket and you're treating them like they're all the same. And at the very least, you should have a hypothesis. Why would there be a relationship between these two things? Because we talked about this earlier, you know, like with horoscopes, you know, like we may find that the last 10 receivers who are the sun sign is Taurus all outproduce their draft position. Does that mean that we should, you know, the classic what players draft born on a Tuesday or whatever.
Right.
So just because there's a relationship doesn't mean there's anything useful or actionable there. And then I think where analytics fails us is at when we drill down and ask about one case. And like I said, analytics can tell us based on these factors, we can have a 55-45 proposition. And yes, if you stack up 55-45 propositions, you will profit in the long run. Don't, and that's not just not how I play fantasy football. Like I said, manager retirement portfolio that way. But I think that when we drill down to one case, Jordan, we see that, well, there are differences, right? And what we really can do to advance this cause is look at all the cases in the on and all the cases in the off and see what they have in common and then start to discern relationships, right? And then you can, then you have a better chance to say, well, here are the cases that always adhere to the rule. They generally look like this. And the cases that don't adhere to the rule generally look like this. Here's case N plus one. What does it look more like, this or this? Instead of just blindly saying it's a 64% proposition, I'm going to go with 64%, because we can ask more questions. We have access to more data. And so that's what I mean when I say analytics give you a place to start, a place to ask questions, but only by looking at the individual case can you come up with your best answer to the question. And that's where the news and processing all this stuff comes in. And I think another layer to this, going back to your original question, is you just get used to beat writers. One of the good things about consuming all this is you get used to beat writers. You understand which ones like to inject their opinion. You understand which ones are super conservative. You understand which ones are mouthpieces of agents or teams. You understand which ones actually know football. You understand which ones maybe don't know football, but get really good information. So if they're putting something out there, you understand which who likes to hint at things, right? Like it sometimes there are beat writers that, Adam Schefter is a good example of this. Some of the best information Adam Schefter puts out there are things that he couches as his opinion, or he just says, don't be surprised if, or something like that, because it's not something he can report, and he can't really out his sources by saying, I know this, but he can float it out there if you're listening. So I think by consuming all that and you let it wash over you, kind of by osmosis, certain pieces of information have a little gleam to them. And then you want to say, I'm going to pay attention to that. Let me give you a very timely example, because I can say all this, but Dr. Gene, who is the levelest of all level heads, he is the levelest head person I've ever met in my life. And he's always consuming all this information about injuries, including information that is absent. Sometimes it's just by omission. There's information by omission, right? And our own Jason Wood brought up back in around July 4th, back in our little forum where we all talk to each other out there, football guys, that there was never confirmation that Michael Thomas had surgery, even though it was expected. And he was asking Dr. Gene, did you ever find any confirmation of this? And then last night on our live show, I asked Dr. Gene an open-ended question. I just said, give me a player that you are going to be very interested in the news about him when training camp opens. And he said, Joe Burrow, which, okay, yeah, Joe Burrow. And he said, Michael Thomas. And I sat up, I was like, whoa, Michael Thomas. Because Michael Thomas was on the field for OTAs. Whoa, wait. And Gene just basically said, hey, the kind of surgery we think he had would have had a 4 to 6 month time frame, and if he had it right after the season, wow, if he's on the field in June participating in OTAs, that's a pretty early return. And I hope he didn't have a setback. And I'll be watching just to make sure that his reconditioning and everything is going well. Because to Dr. Gene, those things just didn't jive. That he would be on the field in June and after having a pretty extensive ankle surgery in, would have been what, like mid, late January. And so that was something that to him just stood out. I was like, no, that doesn't feel right. So obviously there was like a 12-hour period when that was actionable. But the point is, the more you consume, the more things just present themselves to you as important. And you don't necessarily know why, and you don't necessarily have all the details, but you understand. I remember there was one Sidney Rice like 12 years ago or so, when Sidney Rice had some sort of hip surgery, and there was just no news about it. There was no news that he was getting back on the field. And I remember saying, I'm a little worried because I haven't heard anything. And then the next thing we heard about Sidney Rice was he was going to have some sort of revision surgery or something like that. And he was going to miss the first 3 months of the season. So I think that by consuming all that news and understanding how these things sequentially make stories that end up swaying our fantasy leagues, you have a chance to get the drop on other people in your league.
Yeah, it's I blame myself for the injuries this week. I think I told you before we started recording.
Quiet.
I said this is like the quietest week of the year. It's boring, like pre-Olympics, post basketball, you know, I'm a Tour de France guy, post Tour de France, like no training camp. Like this is like the deadest week. And here we have Cam Akers and Michael Thomas. That's all on me. It's interesting when you said the thing about the analytics. I actually it's fun because like you get the holy wars between the analytics and the tape people. And I'm always of the kind of the opinion, like you're like, if you're that sort of committed, I mean, yeah, I mean, it's analytics of dynasty. So we sort of have a place where we come from, but at the same time, like we have to understand what we don't know. Right. And I think that what you said is interesting. Like the two guys that me to present the easiest in this category is Trey Sermon versus Michael Carter. Like we know that historically Trey Sermon has a double hit, like his hit rate is twice as high as Michael Carter's based on just their draft round, right? Like just knowing those things, that's just their base rate. And then you have to kind of figure out like, is that like, can you build up a narrative to make it so that way you can like justify taking Carter over Sermon, because it needs to be a lot to sort of go in that direction to be right. And that's more of a dynasty take than it maybe is maybe in redraft, he's got more of an angle this year, but it's an interesting, like how you sort of frame that to think that someone has the answer figured out. Like it's kind of all moving probabilities, and you sort of have to understand the bet. There's absolutely times to go away from it and to use additional information. And it's ultimately, you know, when people put really precise numbers on it, it sort of makes me a little nervous because there's so much that we don't know, to your point.
And we can put probabilities on things, but we're still doing it on a limited lens, right? And when we start getting down to the individual case. So let me give you an example, right? Like Trey Sermon versus Travis Etienne in dynasty drafts. And I know, and some of these people may look very smart when they say, there ain't no way I'm ever taking a third round pick over a first round pick in a rookie draft. That's just stupid. Why would you ever do that? But then when you start getting into more contextual information here, well, Travis Etienne is being drafted into a backfield with an accomplished running back who's only in the second year of the rookie contract. Travis Etienne is with a college coach that is kind of like a volatile in terms of knowing how he's going to be used, whether they're going to rationally put him in a role that he's suited for. Meanwhile, Trey Sermon is on a team that is probably going to be among the top three most efficient running teams in the league, right? And a team that just traded away most of their future to get Trey Lance, traded up for him in the third round. So is he a typical third round pick? Do you trust Kyle Shanahan? Meanwhile, Trey Sermon's competition for touches next year is going to be right. Elijah Mitchell, right?
Right.
Where James Robinson is probably not going away. Now, James Robinson could get traded, blow this up. But as soon as you say it's, if you just look at it at the level of a third round pick versus a first round pick, you're missing so much. You're missing so many details that could be persuasive, that whenever Trey Sermon's more valuable than Travis Etienne, people will say, well, of course, that's what happened.
Right. Yeah. The Trey Sermon, I don't evaluate landing spot too much. Like that was the first time since Kamara I made a huge move based on landing spot.
Yeah,
like it's been
another player that a team had a conviction, moved up for,
yep,
had a plan for, and it's not foolproof.
No,
but at the same time, I know people say don't trade up in the draft and things like that. But I would guess that when teams trade up for a running back on the first or second day, that at the very least you have going for you is what I was saying with AJ Dillon, that the regime is going to really try hard to show everybody just how smart they were to take that pick. Now, it doesn't mean it's going to work out like Bishop Sankey or whatever. Like you look at the guy and say, he can't play. I don't care. Mm-hmm. So there's no cut and dry rules. And there are sometimes that we should say the analytics were right all along. We should have followed in there. Sometimes we say the film was right. We should have followed it. And what we need to do is look for the similarities between those cases so we can have a better understanding of which drawer to put these things in than just blindly put things in one drawer or the other.
Yeah, I like it. Can we talk about the five storylines for you that might define whether it's your rankings or what you think might define how this training camp plays out?
Yeah. There's so many, right? I mean,
yeah.
Let's just throw into one bucket, like ascendant offenses, or which offenses are going to be the ascendant offenses. Because what you have with ascendant offenses are, I always like to do the analogy of like when we were in middle school, you know, like sometimes people would hit puberty over the summer and you would come back and be like, whoa, you're totally different than the last time I saw you, you know?
Right.
And I think that's how some of these offenses could be. Like look at the Bills offense last year, right? We want to look for offenses that can make a much larger production pie. So it means larger slices. So even if you've got a smaller slice of a bigger pie, you can be better off, more efficient offenses. So just off the top of my head, I think that Miami has to be one that we consider here. Probably the Patriots. I mean, their offensive lines can be reconstituted. They have a lot more talent. There's the Jets are interesting. The Jets aren't necessarily going to get into the top half of offenses in the league, Jordan. But what's a team-wide Adam Gase effect look like? I'm excited, although at this moment I want to say rest in peace, Greg Knapp, big loss for a lot of football families, including the Jets there. But they will carry on, and they will be a lot better offense than what we saw under Adam Gase. Tennessee's interesting because of the addition of Julio Jones. We've never seen a Tennessee offense with the right hand and the left hand in the passing game like they have with Julio Jones. Even Indianapolis is interesting because of Carson Wentz. With Frank Reich, if his head gets right and his game gets right and he's lined up to do things that he's successful at, this is going to be a better offense than that Rivers offense last year, assuming Eric Fisher's okay with the Achilles. Cleveland's an offense that could take a step forward. They were just getting it together in the second half of the year last year. How exciting is it that Cleveland plays Kansas City week one, by the way? I'm so hyped for that already.
Yeah.
That's going to be awesome. I think that we should also look at Philadelphia, offensive line's back. I know that I'm not necessarily a Jalen Hurts believer, but that thing was going down in flames last year.
Mm-hmm.
Dallas, we haven't seen a whole year with Dak Prescott. Remember, Prescott was playing behind an offensive line that was already compromised when he was doing what he was doing last year. Offensive line's healthy for now, knock on wood. San Francisco, again, is interesting with the addition of Alex Mack. You bring back Trent Williams. You put a running quarterback in there. Folks remember what Robert Griffin III did in a Kyle Shanahan offense as a running quarterback. Do you even remember anybody that was in that Washington pass offense?
Pierre Garçon.
Yes, right? Old Pierre Garçon. Old Pierre Garçon.
Yeah, Mount Union.
Yes, but also guys like Leonard Hankerson, Aldrick Robinson, Fred Davis. These were the targets that Robert Griffin III has. And Trey Lance is going to have a lot better targets than that. Chicago's interesting with Justin Fields. So the point is we're going to get reveals on all these offenses, at least partial reveals. And you want to look for the offenses that they're creating a sense of excitement. They're creating a sense of just you wait and see. Even Tampa, just like Cleveland, was just getting it together in the second half of the year. So that's just one big long storyline as I go on and on. The rookies, and that's another catch-all, but the rookies, this is where narrative comes in, Jordan, right? Is you can look at the outliers. And we usually know in their first summer, right? You can look back at the players, and there's exceptions. Like Justin Jefferson, for instance, was totally nondescript and actually seemed like a negative indicator last summer. So it's not always following this. But generally, Elijah Moore comes to mind right away. Generally, when a player is going to be special, right away you start hearing reports as soon as he gets on the practice field, yeah, we think he's going to be special. They don't always turn out special, but we're looking for those reports, especially as the intensity goes up from OTAs to training camp. We're like from other players on the team saying, yeah, wow, we're really excited to have this guy. Jacksonville is just its own story because I have no idea how to project that offense.
Yeah.
I have no idea if Urban Meyer is just going to do his own thing and be totally ignorant of anything on the field that's trying to tell him what to do, or he's actually going to be malleable and look at what players are doing and say, hey, James Robinson's better at getting the tough yards. James Robinson's going to start for us and things like that. We'll see. That's a developing story. You know, we've talked last night on the show, we talked about injuries. There's obviously some players, key players, Saquon Barkley, Joe Burrow, I mentioned, you know, some players coming back from injury and how they look. That's going to shake things up. Mm-hmm. You know, what's funny is I really feel like for every team, we could probably list three or four of these things. Right. Like if you're not looking at a team right now and saying there's give in my projections, there's mm-hmm. give in how I'm going to treat these players, then you're not being honest. And I'm not saying that we're going to get definitive answers to any of this stuff in training camp in the preseason, but at the very least we'll get clues or we'll know which things to pay closer attention to in those first few weeks of the season when adjusting quickly to the new reality is the most important quality for a fantasy football player.
Yeah, I think the big, you know, just a couple. I was just looking through your rankings earlier.
Yeah.
The big one that jumped off right at the face, 17 games for Aaron Rodgers in your projections, which I think that's obviously a good.
Yeah.
It's good for us. You think he'll come back this week?
So this is my first year doing season long projections.
Mm-hmm.
And you have all these quarterback situations, right? I mean, that's another whole topic to answer your previous question, right? Like New England, I already mentioned Fields mm-hmm. and Lance's quarterback competitions there, right? Denver mm-hmm. has a quarterback competition that's going to change the complexion of the offense. And then there's this Green Bay situation and the Houston situation. And I just don't know how to split the baby, right? I feel like you either have to project that Aaron Rodgers is going to play 17 games or zero games.
Mm.
I don't know. This is something we've talked about a lot with holdouts. Last time this came up, I think, was a Le'Veon Bell issue, where it's once they miss the first game, they're as likely to go, you know, 4, 6, 8, 10 games into the season as they are just to say after 1 week, ah, psych, just kidding, everything's cool. So I feel like you just have to pick a lane. But that's my projections. Now, in my rankings, I can split the baby. In my rankings, I can say there's a risk factor for Aaron Jones. There's a risk factor for Davante Adams. There's a risk factor for Robert Tonyan. And gauge about where that risk factor moves them down, usually within a tier, not down to a different tier, but within their tier. It may move them down to the bottom of their tier. Whereas when I'm trying to get to hard numbers, I just don't know if it makes sense to project that Aaron Rodgers is going to play 13 games or 14 games or 15 games or 12 games. I think 17 and 0 are the answers. Now, when you get into Fields and Lance, it gets a little more difficult because I think we all envision a scenario for Chicago where Dalton starts week one, but eventually Matt Nagy is going to have to start Fields. And for San Francisco, maybe we'll get an answer earlier. But again, there's a lot of different ways for Lance to get on the field. And that one's crucially important. Look, all these are important, right? If Locke is the starter, we want Sutton. If Bridgewater is the starter, we want Judy. If Dalton's the starter, we want Allen Robinson. If Fields is the starter, I think that's good for Darnell Mooney.
Mm-hmm.
If Lance is the starter, all of the passing, like the whole passing attempt pie gets smaller for San Francisco, but maybe we like the running backs better. So each of these questions, you should, if not commit with your rankings and commit with your draft plans, just know the implications. So when we start to get indications it's going one way or the other, you can act accordingly. Damian Harris and Mac Jones, you know, these are all things that, as soon as you start to hear news about this, you'll know the implications. You'll know, oh man, Mac Jones had a really good day of practice. Cam Newton has had four bad days in a row. Maybe I should be moving Damian Harris up.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the big one for me. Like of the running back ones, the situations,
right.
Like if Mac Jones starts like wheels up for Damian Harris, like yeah,
he's like Mark Ingram, 2019, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's just such they had by so far the most, running back or quarterback rushes in the red zone. Like that was almost their entire offense. Mm-hmm. And those snaps are going to not be Mac Jones rushes many of them, I wouldn't suspect. So, but that's definitely, you project Cam Newton to be the season long starter. Okay.
Well, and I actually, So I looked the last time I updated my projections, and I have to update them again as soon as we're done doing this for the Michael Thomas injury.
Yeah.
The last time I looked at my projections, I wanted to project it something more like 9-8 or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But the more I think about it, I think it's another 17-0 kind of situation. And again, narrative belonging in fantasy football. This one's kind of cinematic. I think I've told this story, sum it up for people at least 3 times in the last couple of weeks, because I think it's so compelling, Jordan. So what we had this spring was Mac Jones actually looking solid. Mac Jones looking like a quarterback in practice, running the plays, throwing accurate passes, you know, executing the play the way he's supposed to, which is what you would expect against air, but still he's ready. He can handle it. It's not too big for him, right? Then you have Cam Newton. Cam Newton was terrible. He was spraying the ball all over the field. Some of the plays that they were showing clips of were painful to watch. And then on the final day of OTAs, vintage Cam Newton shows up and just puts on a show and leaves that as the image for the Patriots coaches to be thinking about going into training camp. So I think this is really a TBD situation. And I do think that if Cam Newton continues to be vintage Cam Newton, or show that it was COVID and it was no offseason, and you know, just there's a lot of intricacies to Josh McDaniels' offense that they couldn't really get into because of everything last year. And now we can see something closer to even late career Cam Newton, but late career Cam Newton executing an offense. Remember, the offensive line is going to be excellent.
Mm-hmm.
Even without Joe Tooney, this offensive line looks like it's going to be really good. They made vast improvements at tight end and at wide receiver to give them a functional offense, which they didn't have last year. It was the hardest offense to watch. A first down felt like a Herculean task for this offense last year. So, If it's Cam Newton, then you're riding Cam Newton until the wheels fall off. And I think if Mac Jones genuinely outplays Newton in camp, then it's Newton sitting and Jones week one. But it is a very difficult one to gauge, because I think it really will be determined by camp.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. What do you think about the, this was going to be like my most interesting, especially dynasty one, because I think there's like long-term implications from it, but now I feel less good about it with the Michael Thomas news. But the Winston Taysom Hill thing, the competition there.
Yeah, and this is one where there's a lot of different variables here that are difficult to gauge, because we're talking about psychoanalyzing coaches. Just right. Like, I mean, really, we are.
Right.
Because Peyton played Hill over Winston for 4 games last year while Breeze was out, even though Winston was the backup. What does that mean? The story I've heard is that it was Peyton really wanted to see what Taysom Hill could do. He knew that the two of the first 3 games were against Atlanta. The second game was the debacle against Denver, which wasn't even a real football game.
Right.
And the fourth game was against Philadelphia, and they lost. And Taysom Hill was probably a big part of the reason they lost that game, at least his play in the first half of that game. And maybe Hill would have been replaced. And then you get this report from Ben Valin, who's a semi-connected national writer for the Boston Globe, saying Hill will get the first shot. Kind of like Hill will get a chance to be the starter until he shows he shouldn't be. Similarly to what he had last year. Well, if you look at the schedule, they open with Green Bay. That's no easy out. And then they get Carolina. Okay. And then New England, the Giants, and Washington. So if the consideration is Hill's the starter until he face plants, I see a reasonable possibility he face plants in those first 5 games. And then that's that. The other thing that people pointed out that I think is persuasive when I consider this is that Hill doesn't just have to beat out Winston. Hill has to beat out Winston plus the change up value of Hill whenever he's a contrast to Winston, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the impact of all of those gadget plays, the impact of, Taysom Hill's in the huddle, we have to fall back on the special preparation we did just this week just for the Taysom Hill packages, is lost if Hill's the starter. Because then you're preparing for Taysom Hill, and those are kind of bread and butter things in the offense. So I think that that's something Sean Payton understands, and I think that's why a lot of people in New Orleans writing about the Saints are putting their thumb on the scale and saying, yeah, there's a competition, but it's probably going to be Winston.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting, and I thought this was a big payoff situation because Michael Thomas is undervalued, and it's might not be now. So it's definitely disappointing. All right, can we talk a couple minutes about Syracuse basketball?
Please.
All right.
Please.
Favorite Syracuse basketball moment.
Oh, I mean, it's well, okay. I mean, it's when they beat Kansas. I mean, Hakeem Warrick's block. You know, I mean, actually, the funny thing is, if I can say when they beat Kansas, I could also say when I was a junior, Syracuse went to the Final Four, and it was a Jock Vaughn clanker that sent them to the Final Four in 1996. So both of them is that's why I said when they beat Kansas, but really it was the national championship. I think long-suffering Syracuse basketball fans. I was a Pitt basketball fan growing up, and then when I went to Syracuse, obviously I was in the tank for Syracuse. You almost thought you'd never see it. At a certain point, I'm sure folks that really lived through 87 and Keith Smart and just how painful that was. I think that happened down here in New Orleans.
Yes. Cause it was revenge. Cause the 03 national championship was in New Orleans and it was redemption.
Right. After they played the regional final in Albany, I think it was basically
amazing. I was there and it was, it was like no environment I had experienced. And it's about the only time it's ever been different, more intense than that was when Syracuse played. I remember when Syracuse played Georgetown the last time they carried home, like it was one of those energies you could feel in your toes.
Yeah.
Like it reverberated out of the floor. And then the Duke games have always been that way. But I mean, it was a top five and they absolutely just blew the doors off Oklahoma. That I remember just that game. It was, we were sitting in the Oklahoma section and it was 2-1 Syracuse fans to Oklahoma in the Oklahoma section. I was like, this is going to be is going to be an amazing atmosphere.
Well, they were a team of destiny that year. And I think we lose track of this now, but back in 2003, it was unheard of for a college team to be led by two freshmen and a sophomore. I mean, it was before players were constantly jumping in NBA after a year or two. And it was really a special team. And I hope that everybody who's lived and died with a team and finally got to see them win a championship looks at them this way. Because Jordan, I look back on that team and between Carmelo Anthony, and let me tell you about Carmelo Anthony. I've been to Puerto Rico. You cannot go more than like 15 miles in Puerto Rico without seeing a Carmelo Anthony basketball court, like a basketball court that he had put in down there.
Well,
like,
really?
Like a community basketball court. Yeah, it's incredible. He really that part of his background. The other thing, of course, I'm a Pittsburgh person, so I'm going to say. And then there's Roberto Clemente, who's like you know, the Pope or something like that. He's half Puerto Rican, and he's very connected to Puerto Rico. Anyway, and then you have Hakeem Warrick, and man, I'll get teary. I could just go watch him making that block.
Mm-hmm.
To basically clinch. I can watch that, and I can watch Marc-Andre Fleury making that save with like 0.5 seconds left against the Red Wings in 2009. Like these moments where like you pull the sword from the stone. But the best of all is Jerry McNamara. Jerry McNamara is like out of a folk song. He's out of a tall tale. He's like Paul Bunyan or something. Really? And I love that he's still with the program. And I love that he did all that stuff with Buddy. I love how that revived that story. We could go back to the pictures of Buddy Boeheim when he was just a little kid with those national championship guys, like hanging out with them when he was just a little tyke. I mean, we think we care about Syracuse basketball. Nobody cares about Syracuse basketball more than Buddy Boeheim. You know, they said he would cry after every loss when he was a kid. And then when his dad got home, he would cry again. he was that into it. But Jerry McNamara, what I think people may not know about him is going back to when he was in high school, he was already this guy. He was already somebody who did amazing things that nobody had seen until he did it. And of course you have that, what was it against UConn? It was like a 5-overtime game or a 6-overtime game.
It would have been that was the 2009 Big East Championship game.
Right,
And when Dievendorf hit the three to put the to win it, and it was just on his hand as a buzzer, and it was the song "Some of God's Greatest Gifts Are Unanswered Prayers." Like that's one of those things where it was like it was just I remember exactly where I was, and there's a really famous the Sports Center call from that night goes on for like 15 minutes of them breaking down that game. And it's on YouTube, and it's hilarious because they're like, you know, and Syracuse, and they were like, you know, in the fourth overtime, similar story, UConn leads, and like Syracuse never led.
Right.
He never led in overtime until Routens makes the first three at the beginning of the sixth overtime. It's unbelievable that you can tie five times and have never led in an overtime. In overtime. It's just that's one of the national championship games right there. And then there's been games recently that's been really, you know, like the unexpected run that they made to the Final Four when they came back against Virginia. And that was one of those ones where I was just like, I couldn't believe what I was seeing. Like I just couldn't believe that they'd come all the way back.
Yeah. Well, the famous story my wife would tell, I'm going to tell this story in public for the first time, is Jordan, everybody throw your tomatoes at me. I actually left the bar when they went down like 12 or 14 points in the second half
to Virginia.
Like, yeah. I was like, that's enough. I was, I've seen enough. I think it was on Easter, right? It was the Easter.
Yeah. Miracle. It was Easter Sunday. It was Sunday.
The Easter miracle. I was like, that's enough. I've seen enough. Let's go have some more ham or something. But going back to the reason I brought up the overtime game was the Big East tournament. I think Jerry McNamara, after Carmelo and Warwick were gone, had another epic Big East tournament, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, it was the run in 06, right? They weren't going to make the
tournament. They won.
Yeah. Right? And then they ran. Yeah, he went just – he had the best four games of any, you know, of any tournament stretch of anyone in Syracuse history.
Yeah, he was really outrageously good, but people forget from the national championship game, how many threes did he make in the first half of that game?
Six. Made six threes.
A record.
Mm-hmm.
That's unreal.
Mm-hmm.
That's unreal. Even though he got hurt and he wasn't, and they had to hang on. I mean, he gave them he was the solid rocket booster that night that got them free of the gravity of all of the Syracuse disappointments.
Yeah.
So I love remembering that 2003 team because it had epic figures doing epic things.
I remember the first night of that 2002-2003 season, Carmelo came in and he was like it's funny because this is almost 20 years ago now, but this was back before freshman phenoms were a thing. You know, this is back before Anthony Davis and all these guys have come in as freshmen. Like you didn't have high expectations. They didn't make a difference. And I remember I must have had baseball practice or something. And I asked her for some reason, I didn't watch the game. And my dad came to pick me up from wherever I was. And I was like, hey, how'd they play? You know, how's the new guy? It's like, well, he can't defend, but he can absolutely score. And I was like, okay. I was like, all right, like that's good. And then, you know, to where they ended up. And it's funny because my dad went to SU, and actually I lived there my first year of life. I actually lived on campus.
Right on.
He's been a Syracuse fan forever. And it was funny because he, you know, it was that 87 year I was born right after. And then he went back to school in 88, or then the fall of 87 and 88. And it's just so funny because that arc. And then I remember seeing Carmelo came to do a autograph session or whatever at the local YMCA. And I brought like a magazine, and everyone was like, oh, I want a picture. I was like, I just want to thank him so that way I don't have to hear my dad complain about Syracuse basketball ever again. I literally walked up to him and I was like, you don't understand. I was like, you don't understand how much like this victory means to people. And I was like a 16-year-old kid or whatever. But I was like, you have no idea. I was like, you just have no idea. Cause it like, and someone was, I heard someone complaining about the Eagles, and I was like, you don't have a right to complain. I was like, you can't. I was like, they've won a ring. Like you've got it, you know. And it's funny. So, but you're firmly on the SU versus Pitt side now, right?
Yeah, I think it's one of those things. Once it's in your blood. And don't get me wrong, there have been some Pitt teams that have also been denied glory, basketball wise. You know, there's the team that lost to Villanova on that amazing back and forth game.
Mm-hmm.
Going back to when I was a kid, before I went to Syracuse, they were about to. They had a fantastic team. Remember, send it in, Jerome. Jerome Lane and Charles Smith and Demetrius Gore. And then they had this incredible group of freshmen join them, including Sean Miller. That, you know, those teams looked like they really had a chance. And they lost on a buzzer beater. Well, Vanderbilt hit a buzzer beater, Barry Goheen, I'll never forget it, to send the game to overtime, and they lost. You know, just the underachieving teams. But the Syracuse basketball, I think, is a special. I know that it doesn't have the Duke and North Carolina and Kentucky and Kansas kind of aura about them, but I think that the fan base is just as rapt or mesmerized by the team and connected to the team in a way that once it's in your blood, it's never out of your blood. And I think what people outside of the Northeast don't understand is Syracuse is not just a team representing Syracuse.
Right.
It's representing really the whole state of New York, honestly. I think you can even go down to the city, especially since Pearl Washington, I think. Mm-hmm. Syracuse is the basketball team of New York State, especially upstate New York, though. Like every hardcore Bills fan that you meet is also a hardcore Syracuse fan, right? So I think that that's one of those things, and it just gives the team a lot of, I don't know, man. I think that the more devotion and the more emotional investment that a fan base has in a team, maybe it doesn't ensure they're going to win. Maybe it doesn't change the outcome, but your emotional connection to the memories becomes a lot stronger, right? Mm-hmm. And I think it becomes a lot stronger too. This is where I'm going to do something that's going to offend some people. But I think, like you said, you were an infant on Syracuse campus. Mm-hmm. You know, you go there for 4 years and all these formative experiences of your life are connected to that place and that symbol. Then you have this emotional investment that I think is a little bit different. And this is where I'm going to go. See, I'm really going to go and make some people mad. But I know so many people that chose to be Duke fans or chose to be North Carolina fans or chose to be Kentucky fans. Now, I do know a lot of Kentucky fans that grew up in Kentucky. And you earned that, baby. Mm-hmm. You earned that. You earned all your Kentucky basketball love if you grew up in Kentucky. But I think that I don't meet very many people that chose to be Syracuse fans. I think we were all in one way or another born into it.
Yeah. 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 And it doesn't, the emotion of that doesn't, you know, the 35,000 people in that building, like there's very few things that you can feel that are like that.
And it's like when it's like negative 25 outside and you've got 13 layers of clothes on and then you get inside and there's the lights and the warmth and everybody. I mean, it's.
And no air conditioning. There's no. There.
You know, I worked in this Carrier Dome a lot when I was a student there. Yes. And yes, it was, it's hard to believe that it was ever the cutting edge technology at any time.
Right. Yeah. I think they just, in the new rework they did, air conditioning. I believe that is true.
That's hilarious.
It's been, you know, the Carrier Dome for what, 40 years. Yeah. 40 years. And it's, you know, never had AC. So, one of the great misnegotiated contracts of all time. They can't get out of that naming deal.
Yeah. So,
well, Sig, I want to thank you for coming on. This
was
fun. And, you know, it's always nice when we can bond over Syracuse basketball because, you know, hopefully better days are ahead. But thanks so much for coming on. Obviously, go check out the Audible. Is the preseason series coming up?
It's coming up. I think we're going to break the seal on it next week, which is always fun. It's a ritual. It's a moment on the calendar. It's where we step through each team and what our starting considerations are at the beginning of training camp, just for the fire hose to blow it all up.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you guys do that in like over a couple of days?
Yeah. We try to record a division a day.
Okay.
And then give ourselves a breather and then they leech out. I don't know exactly how Cecil releases them, but we go through all 32 teams and it's really fun for us because that's when we get to talk about players, you know, well, some of these players end up mattering, like Xavier Jones, mm-hmm. Marquez Callaway. Like already you can see before the preseason watch list, I promise you, we were going to have a section on Xavier Jones. We were going to have a section on Marquez Callaway and so on. Because knowing these names, maybe you're not going to take them in your draft. You're not going to pick them up off the waiver wire in week two. But by week 12, week 13, week 14, they become very important.
Yeah, for sure. So go ahead, check that out. And obviously, you know, the whole Audible, the entire Audible podcast series, and then all the
including the Dynasty show,
including the Dynasty show. You know, when I wrote the analytics of Dynasty, I wrote down on a whiteboard behind me. I said, "What are my goals in the fantasy football space?" And I said, and there was two things on it. One was to appear on SiriusXM Radio, which I did, and the other one was to become a Football Guy staff writer. So I got them both.
Nice.
So
beautiful.
Yes.
If you will it, it is no dream.
Yes. Yes, that's for sure. Well, that'll do it for this Sunday strategy session. Thank you, Sigmund Bloom. Until next time, continue embracing the variance. We'll talk again very soon.